sitting at the table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy. And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Work.
Peace.
Losers.
Men.
This is my mistake. And let me make it good. I raise the wall. And I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Progress.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
Fill in the border. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We are building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and with me today is my co-host Gordon Barnes. We're going to touch on a few important human rights topics this afternoon, and one of the most important is Cindy Blackstock's visit to University of Regina to deliver this year's Woodrow Lloyd Lecture, and we were there. Welcome, Gordon.
Well, thank you, Jim, and welcome as well to everybody who's tuning in to Human Rights Radio today. We've got some good discussion, good information to share, and hope everyone finds this program really interesting. And I think to start with, you were going to share a little bit of news about CJTR and sort of some membership information as well, Jim.
Yep, absolutely. And we just wanted to let you know that CJTR has some new membership options. You now have the option to purchase multi-year and even lifetime membership to CJTR at a discount from our annual rate of just $25. Two-year memberships are $45, 3 years for $65, 5 years for $100, and a lifetime membership is just $250. And there are, of course, benefits that come with a CJTR membership. And if you want to find out about that, you just have to visit www.cjtr.ca/membership. And you'll find out about the benefits. That includes discounts and things like that. So,
good news. You know, there's such a diversity of programming on CJTR in terms of spoken word programs and music that it's a great program station to support and encourage people to look at that option. I know I've been a regular member for years now, and think now that this new option is available, I look at that pretty seriously. So I hope other people will as well. There's a bit of an announcement that we'd like to share now at this point in time as well, later in the program. just so everybody catches the details of this. And we're very excited to share the details with respect to an upcoming trip to Saskatchewan by our Alex Neve, who's the senior staff person for Amnesty International Canada. Alex has been part of research missions to a variety of countries around the world where there are significant human rights concerns, including South Sudan. He's been to Colombia a number of times, Mexico, of course, and to the DRC, and really provided incredible leadership within our movement within Canada. And he'll be here in Saskatchewan, initially in Saskatoon, on March 10th, and a number of events are being arranged there. Also here in Regina on March 11th. He'll be speaking twice, actually, the first time at 2:30 in the afternoon, and the talk there will be at the university. We'll have more details about this on our AmnestySaskatchewan.ca website, but the first talk he'll be doing at 2:30 in the afternoon will be about Amnesty International's current campaign to stop torture, and a really significant initiative that the international movement is involved in. The evening talk that will be at 7 o'clock will be a different topic, and it'll be about putting human rights on the upcoming Canadian election agenda. So, again, I'm sure both presentations will be very interesting and a great opportunity to hear Alex. If you've never heard him speak before, he's a powerful advocate for human rights and does tremendous work. So I'd encourage everybody to mark those times and dates in your calendar coming up fairly soon. So now what we wanted to do is turn a little bit to a recent event in Regina and some of the things that are going on relative to that in the next short while. Cindy Blackstock, who is the leader of the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, was, as Jim mentioned, a guest speaker at the University of Regina recently. It was a full house. The education auditorium was just full, and people standing room only at the back, and she gave a great presentation, talked about the advocacy work of her organization, and shared information about how people in the community can support that initiative. And as a bit of background, her organization is currently, and this has been ongoing for a while now, got a human rights complaint before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. The arguments were heard last fall, but the background of this is actually that this has been going on for a number of years.
2007.
Right, because as you mentioned, Jim, it's been going on for a number of years, and it's really because, unfortunately, the federal government has been using what it can do in terms of every avenue to block this from proceeding. But the arguments that they were presenting were heard last fall, both from the perspective of the federal government and also Cindy Blackstock's organization, the First Nations Child and Caring Society. A decision is expected in April, so it's coming up quite soon. And the whole question there really is, and then we're going to be sharing some stuff where we are going to have an opportunity to hear Cindy Blackstock talk fairly soon, but it really is about the question of equity for young people who are living on reserve, either in terms of support for family and social services, but also support for education for young people who are going to school on reserve. All the research has shown there are significant disparities in terms of the level of funding, and really that's what the complaint is about that's before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. So what we wanted to do now is give people an opportunity to to listen to Cindy Blackstock and learn more about how individuals can get involved in that.
You know, just in passing here, I'd just like to say, I think when the federal government decided to tangle with her, I don't think they knew what they were getting into. But this will give you a sense of what Ms. Blackstock is all about. And she's got a lot of common sense and a very strong person, I would say. Anyway, here she is.
So as a social worker, you always see that you're going to the poor neighborhoods, that house on the street of the poor neighborhood that's in a worse condition. And yet when you talk to many social workers or foster parents, we often feel powerless about how we're going to help families when those factors are beyond the ability of the individual to control on their own. So we're going to go through right now 7 free ways you can make a difference in under 2 minutes. You can do it as a person of any age and as an organization. So no excuses. You can take action that will meaningfully help address some of these disadvantages that you're seeing in your practice every single day. And not only can you do it, but you can get youth in care to do it, foster parents to do it, children in your own families to do it, your service clubs, your faith groups, and join us in creating a social movement where the landscape of Canada is only one of possibility and honor for Aboriginal children and not one of disadvantage and risk. So the Caring Society has these 7 free ways to make a difference. And all of these are campaigns, but they're bound by the idea of culturally based equity for children. It's about saying that every child should get an equitable opportunity to succeed and be proud of who he or she is. So here's a list of some of the campaigns. The first one is Jordan's Principle. What a lot of people don't understand is that the federal and provincial governments don't agree on who should pay for services for First Nations children, even when those services are available to all other kids without question. And too often what happens is the two levels of government argue, and then the child gets left out of the mix. They fall through the cracks. Jordan's Principle is named of Georgian River Anderson. And what it says is when these disputes arise and the service is available to all other kids, the child gets service from the government of first contact and they can argue as long as they like about getting reimbursed later. In this way, children come first. The second campaign deals with inequalities in education. Many people are not aware that education laws from the province and territory apply on reserves, but the federal government is supposed to fund it. Shannon's Dream is named in memory of Shannon Kustacher from Attawapiskat First Nation. And she was a child who was one of 45 children in the world to be recognized by the Nobel laureates for her action she's taking to improve the education rights of First Nations children on reserve. What many people don't know is that First Nations students on reserve get about $2,000 to $3,000 less per student per year for education funding. That means less teachers. That means no libraries. It means very little science equipment or learning resources for special needs students. On top of that, the Parliamentary Budget Officer has said that the schools on many First Nations communities are in deplorable condition. Some of them are infested with snakes, with mice, with black mold. And in Shannon's case, her school sat atop a contaminated brown field with over 30,000 gallons of diesel fuel. So Shannon's Dream is really in memory of Shannon Kustacher, who tragically died at the age of 15 years of age last year. But she dedicated her entire life to safe and comfy schools and equitable and culturally based education. There are now thousands of Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal children, students, teachers, and citizens who are engaging in a process of saying to the government that racial discrimination against children is not a legitimate fiscal restraint measure. And as a country, we've made a decision that every child counts and no one should be left behind. The next campaign is the I Am a Witness campaign. What we have found is that First Nations children are subject to provincial and territorial child welfare laws, but the federal government underfunds severely child welfare services on reserve, and that drives children unnecessarily into foster care, simply because they're denied the services that even non-Aboriginal families receive off reserve. So after 10 years of working with the federal government to address it, even though they were running billions of dollars of surplus or spending billions of dollars to stimulate the economy, they didn't do the right thing for First Nations children. So in partnership with the Assembly of First Nations, The Caring Society in 2007 filed a human rights complaint against the government, alleging that they're racially discriminating against First Nations children by underfunding child welfare services and giving them less benefit under child welfare laws. This case is supported by over 7,000 witnesses. And by being a witness, we're not asking you to take our side. We're asking you to go through the I Am a Witness website, read all of Canada's documents, read our documents, and then make up your own mind if after several years after the apology for residential schools, the Canadian government is doing the right thing for First Nations children. The next one is the Touchstones of Hope program, which says that, you know, when we have culturally based and equitable funding, we need to be able to use it for maximum effect. And the best people to do it, help us understand that are community members themselves. So it engages community members along with child welfare workers, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, in developing a vision for healthy children and then being able to implement that in very practical ways. The final one is Many Hands, One Dream. And Many Hands, One Dream is basically the same as the Touchstones of Hope, except for Aboriginal health. It really guides us in being able to have the ultimate outcomes for Aboriginal children served by the healthcare system in Canada. And in fact, one of the things we're really excited about is in partnership with the Many Hands, One Dream Coalition, there's just been a release of curriculum for pediatricians. And we're hoping to be able to spread that out to healthcare providers so that they, like child welfare workers, have an opportunity to optimize health outcomes for Aboriginal children and young people. The final thing you can do is learn more, not only as a person, but as in your family unit. Engage your children in learning about the rich history of this land that's now known as Canada. You know, Canada is a First Nations word. It means village. And it's just one of the many wonderful legacies left to all of us from Aboriginal people that have made our country good and great. So you can find out all this information on our website, free of charge, at fncaringsociety.com.
She doesn't mince her words, does she? Yeah. No, she's very, very straightforward. She knows what she's talking about.
And I know I was personally so pleased to have Dr. Cindy Blackstock come to Regina. As I mentioned earlier, the education auditorium at the University of Regina was full with people who wanted to hear her speak, and our special thanks, of course, to the Faculty of Arts at the University of Regina, who are the hosts for the evening. People really responded well, had some great questions. One of the things that Dr. Cindy Blackstock talks about is the work her organization does to get young people involved in this issue, and that means young people who are both Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal people. And throughout the last several years, while this whole case before the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal has been ongoing, they've had large numbers of young people support their campaign. And that includes the Have a Heart campaign, where people are encouraged right now, over the next couple of weeks in particular, to send a Valentine to your member of parliament, to the prime minister and other cabinet ministers, saying, you know, have a heart. We support the work of the First Nations Child and Caring Family Society, and we also would like to see equitable funding for young people who are going to school or needing social services or family services on reserve. And that campaign is something you can undertake in any community you live in, whether it's a small rural community or a large city. Here in Regina, at the University of Regina, the Aboriginal Student Centre is taking the initiative of arranging people to volunteer at a table at the University of Regina over the next couple of weeks. You can actually go to the Aboriginal Student Centre website. It's easy to find. And you can sign up to volunteer to do that. And we'd encourage people to look at doing that as well. This is a really important human rights issue that, as I say, will be decided fairly quickly by the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. One of the things that Dr. Blackstock talked about when she was in Regina was they'd have busloads of young people come in to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal well, that process was ongoing, and listen to the arguments being made by both sides, and the impact that made on young people. So these are school buses showing up at the, because the tribunal, it was actually, the hearing was at the Supreme Court. So they had yellow school buses of kids showing up at the front door of the Supreme Court of Canada and going in, and they behaved well and, you know, took notes and reflected on what they heard. And that was a pretty powerful experience for the young people able to participate. But what we wanted to do now is just share a few minutes. We don't have the time to do all of it, but we wanted to do a little bit of sharing of the kind of reflections from young people who are talking about this whole question of equity for young people who are First Nations people, as I say, going to school in reserve.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you go to the internet and do some browsing, you can find these videos yourself and listen to them and watch them again. I'm going to play this one. I'm going to pause it in a few places so that I can read the script that's there, because I think it's kind of important. So we'll just get it going here.
I am a witness. I am a sentinel. I can see everything that you want to hide.
Okay, now I'm just going to say here now, children and young people share why a historic human rights case on First Nations children, youth, and families matters to them and the Canada they want to grow up in. And in 2007, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society and the Assembly of First Nations filed a human rights complaint against the federal government alleging that Canada is discriminating against First Nations children by failing to provide equitable and culturally based child and family services on reserve. The federal government has spent over $3 million and 5 years in its unsuccessful efforts to get the case dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal will begin hearing evidence, or they began hearing evidence, rather, on February 25th of 2013.
I believe Canada is a country where justice and fairness are important values.
I think it's really unfair that the conditions that First Nations people have to live through every day.
First Nations children are Canadian children and must be treated fairly and equally.
That every child is just as valuable as anyone else, and that no one deserves to be just forgotten in a system that is very old and doesn't really work so well.
Other Canadians need to know that people that are living in Canada don't have the same services that they do.
First Nations people, like in the history of Canada, have faced like a lot of different inequalities in different ways, like throughout history and like now still. Just like people talk about like the residential schools, like those were really sad and terrible. And it's good that we apologize, but an apology doesn't fix it.
Usually most people think Canada is a place where everybody's treated fairly, but then sometimes we forget about our First Nations children.
Aboriginals are growing up and living in situations and places where they don't have the same rights, and this is a black mark on Canada's reputation.
There's not all equal funding for all people in Canada, because they're living in like third world conditions, like people are in like countries in Africa or something.
I want Canada to know that children can change more than just our country, but they can also change the world, and that children can see when there's something wrong and they want to fix it.
Everybody would have access to water and healthcare and education.
And they should have the right to go to a good school, to have houses, clean water, food, and to have actually a real job when they grow up, and to have a dream and to make it come true when they're older.
I'm sure that they need to have everything what we have, like a warm house, lots of stuff to keep them happy, proud, and healthy.
Un abri, une famille, de l'amour, puis l'éducation, la santé.
I feel that First Nations children should grow up in their community.
As I was growing up, I had an elder who taught me a lot of stuff. Like, my mom was really into that, like, because she never had it when she was growing up, because her parents were, they're all sent to residential schools. My dad's parents, too, they're never allowed to come out as who they are.
One of my elders said that it takes a community to raise a child. So everyone's kind of connected, and everyone, kind of looks out for each other. So, we kind of, are like a big family sort of thing. Like, we're all, extended, and we're all looking out for the betterment of each other.
When they're first growing up, they need a good family, a good home. They have to know themselves, who they are as people, especially Aboriginal children. They have to know who they are.
It takes a community to raise a child, not just two people. So if you're taking First Nations children out of their communities, they're cut off from all that, and they don't have those supports and those people that are so important to them and who are going to teach them. Everybody's going to teach that child about who they are and where they're from.
The best place where First Nations children to grow up would be in their families and in the community mostly, because they need a strong foundation and they need to know who they are.
Discrimination is when, because of a certain characteristic like boy or girl, age, or race, is where someone says, oh, you're not good enough for this, or no, you can't have this because you're blah, 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 right? And it makes me feel upset because I think people should be treated equally.
Ben, moi, je trouve que la discrimination, c'est de l'injustice. Je crois qu'il devrait même pas avoir un mot pour ça. On peut pas avoir de l'injustice dans notre propre pays.
Discrimination to me is when someone gets something that's a right and someone else doesn't get something that is a right. So I find that Canada has a lot of rights and that is very nice, but I wish they would keep up to their rights.
I think discrimination is giving somebody something less than another person based on, gender, age, or, skin color.
Discrimination towards First Nations children, from the residential schools to, even our child welfare. They're not there, it doesn't seem like they're there to help, but just to, take the children away.
Okay, and we'll take a break at this point. And I've got some Michael Franti to play out of that, and then we'll continue our discussion. So we'll be right back.
Same as it ever was, but there's gotta be a better way. It's the same as it ever was, but today's a different day. You and me couldn't make that change, but it's the same as it ever was. We better start today.
America's a better place than it was 50 years ago. There's been a whole lot of change, but we got a long way to go. When we used to have a problem, we used to call the police. But who we gonna call when the police make a problem? I'm not saying that they're all bad. I'm not saying that I'm any better. All I'm just trying to say, we could all do a lot better. I say it in my own house, and I say it on the street. I say it on the record, y'all, and I say it on the beat. I paint it on the wall, y'all, so that everybody sees. When we all see justice, then we'll all see peace.
Same as it ever was, but there's gotta be a better way. Today's a different day. You and me couldn't make that change, but it's the same as it ever was. You better start today.
revolution is a battle between the future and the past. The battle's never over, but the future's gonna last. Malcolm had an ex, yo, and the king had a dream. And like Spike Lee said, yo, you should always do the right thing. If the world's full of anger and everybody's got a gun, then what should I say, yo, to my teenage son? Mandela did lockdown for 28 years, but there's millions more, y'all, still raining down tears. I say it in my own house, and I say it on the street. I say it on a record, yo. I say it on a beat. I paint it on a wall, y'all, until everybody sees. When we all see justice, then we'll all see peace.
Same as it ever was, but there's gotta be a better way. It's the same as it ever was, but today's a different day. You and me couldn't make that change, but it's the same as it ever was. You better start today.
They can try to divide us, they can try to increase all the pain and suffering, but this is everybody's street. There is just one love, y'all, and there is just one beat. And when we all see justice, then we'll all see peace.
Same as it ever was, but there's gotta be a better way. Same as it ever was, but today.
And that's Michael Franti. That's, I think, his latest song called Same As It Ever Was. And, of course, the main reason that I play Michael Franti is I really like Michael Franti. Guys around here know that I say, when in doubt, play Michael Franti. Yeah. Michael had some bad news. He tore something in his left knee, and he's having surgery, so he had to cancel a tour that was called the East Coast One Heart, One Soul Tour. And I was at his last performance here in Regina at the Conexus Arts Center, and wow, it's just great. Just a terrific, a kind of a disappointing crowd. As a Michael Franti fan, I would have expected to see it just packed to the rafters, and it wasn't. And I would have to say that Regina, a lot of people in Regina missed a great show. You know, it was wonderful. He came walking through the crowd, singing, as you know, like in the crowd performing, and up on the balcony, and with his wireless mic and that sort of thing, and it was just a lot of fun.
So we're sending out good vibes today to Michael Franti.
Yes, for sure.
He needs some support for his upcoming surgery,
and he's a, as you can tell from the words of the song, he's a great human rights supporter.
Yeah, that's right. Right. So in the second half of Human Rights Radio today, we'd again like to welcome everybody who's tuning in today and over the internet. Jim, you were going to share a little bit of update in terms of somebody who's Amnesty International and lots of other people around the world are really concerned about, and sending appeals to the Saudi Arabian government.
Yeah, this is from the Globe and Mail, and it's a Saudi blogger by the name of Raif Badawi. I believe that's how we pronounce his name. And he was sentenced to be flogged 20 times over on successive Fridays for a total of 1,000 lashes for the crime of criticizing clerics and insulting Islam. He's 31 years old, and that was the sentence he got. And he was also given a 10-year prison sentence and fined about $319,000. He has a family who, he's got some family that lives as refugees in Canada. He is not in Canada. I don't know whether his intention was to come to Canada, but he is a Saudi. And as of Thursday, the lashings had been meted out just once on January the 9th. And, but, you know, the Saudis do have some compassion. They determined that Mr. Badawi was not healthy enough to undergo beatings in the 2 weeks that followed. So he got 20 lashes on January 9th. And then each week thereafter, they decided, you know, the last 2 weeks, they decided that he wasn't healthy enough to get another 20. Anyway, his wife, Ensaf Haider, I guess, okay, so his wife is in Ottawa, so no doubt he's eventually going to follow. Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Anyway, she was in Ottawa on Thursday to back federal politicians and Amnesty International in requesting that Prime Minister Stephen Harper personally demand Mr. Badawi's freedom. Representatives of all political parties stand united in common cause with Mr. Badawi. Liberal MP Erwin Kotler told a news conference he's acting as the legal counsel for Mr. Badawi and Ms. Haider. And he's also enlisting politicians from different countries to press the Saudis to end the cruel and inhuman floggings and to release both Mr. Badawi and the lawyer who was jailed for acting on his behalf. The fact that Ms. Haider and her children, Najwa, who's 11, Tirad, who's 10, and Miriam, who's 7, they've been given refuge in Canada, means this country has a special role to play in trying to end his torture. This is the opinion of Alex Neave, Secretary General for Amnesty International Canada. Mr. Harper's spokesman, Jason MacDonald, said the punishment handed to Mr. Badawi is a gross violation of human dignity, and Canadian officials will continue to raise concerns about his case. But, said Mr. MacDonald, as Mr. Badawi is not a Canadian citizen, we are limited in the actions we may take on his behalf. Still, Ms. Haider says she believes action by Mr. Harper could end her husband's imprisonment. She last talked to Mr. Badawi 3 days ago by telephone. He said, take care of yourself. I said, take care of yourself. Among other interventions, Foreign Affairs Minister John Baird raised the case of Mr. Badawi with a member of the Saudi royal family at a meeting in Switzerland last week. And, of course, in the kingdom at the moment, in Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah has died, and so they're in mourning there. So hopefully this might be an opportunity for them to show clemency just because of that. We can only hope.
And, you know, the human rights concerns with respect to that country are really, really significant, and in addition to his particular case, you know, there have actually been very, very serious human rights concerns where one woman who was literally dragged to her death and beheading just a few weeks ago in Saudi Arabia, she was protesting her innocence, what she was accused of. And this is a country that Canada does have significant relationships with and, you know, is currently in the process. There's a very significant arms deal that has been done. There's a company that is in London, Ontario, that is going to be manufacturing over the next 7 years billions of dollars worth of tanks that will be shipped to Saudi Arabia. You know, and with that kind of relationship that exists, it does raise the issue of, obviously, why Canada would be doing that. But then, at the same time, it does establish that we do have a relationship, and we need to be very forceful in saying, in this case, the floggings need to be stopped, and Raif Badawi needs to be returned to Canada where he can spend his days with his family. So now what we wanted to do is turn to a different topic, and that is the upcoming visit to Regina by Sister Helen Prejean. If you've never had a chance to hear her speak, she's just a fabulous campaigner against the death penalty in the United States. Already there have been a number of people who have been executed in the United States. There's fortunately a very significant debate that's going on in that country now about the appropriateness of the death penalty. And what we wanted to do is provide some people right now an opportunity, who, if you've never heard of Sister Helen Prejean, to listen to her talk about her work. And now she is, by the way, the person who is just so famous for another story called Dead Man Walking, and she refers to that in this interview. So we're going to share that now.
Yeah, she was interviewed on the Rachel Maddow Show, and I'm a big fan of Rachel Maddow. She's on MSNBC, and I guess you would call her kind of a lefty like myself. I admit it. And she's not liked by the Republican establishment very much. But here she is interviewing Sister Prejean.
Relationship with the death penalty in this country. With some states trying to speed it up, others getting rid of it, some debating which way to go, some governors going both ways at once. We have a weird relationship with choosing to kill people who are already imprisoned. We have a weird relationship with the whole idea of a dead man walking, a prisoner confined and contained, living nevertheless with a scheduled date at which the state government will kill them. 20 years ago this year, Sister Helen Prejean, a Catholic nun from Louisiana, published her account of serving as the spiritual advisor to a man who was sentenced to die for a rape and 2 murders in her state. That book, Dead Man Walking, became a very famous movie of the same name, starring Sean Penn as the prisoner and Susan Sarandon as Sister Helen.
The story of Dead Man Walking starts off, and it was very important that it started off with just a little visit, and then little by little she gets more and more involved, and she kind of had all these doubts. And that's what I really liked about her, was that she didn't go into the whole situation a hero. She just got sucked in deeper and deeper and deeper, and the more she knew, the more she got involved.
You're a fool. You are making it so easy for them to kill you, coming across as some kind of a crazed animal, Nazi, racist, mad dog who deserves to die.
Is that what you think?
You are making it so difficult to help you.
You leave.
I'm not going to do that. It's up to you. You want me to go, you say so.
I remember when we had the first edit and we invited her to see it, and I thought, oh my God, I hope she's, you know, is this going to be so hard for her? And I was kind of worried about her emotionally and to have to go through that again. And when it was over, I said, are you all right? And she said, well, actually doing it was much harder. I thought, yeah, oh, dumb me. This is only a movie.
Joining us now for the interview tonight is Sister Helen Prejean of the Congregation of St. Joseph. She's a leading American advocate for abolishing the death penalty. She's the author of Dead Man Walking, which is out 20 years ago now. Sister Helen, thank you so much for being here.
I looked over my shoulder. It was 20 years.
Yeah. How'd that happen?
How'd that happen?
20 years of this advocacy and activism, seeing the way that things have changed. Do you feel like you have a long view now of what works and what doesn't in trying to get people to see this issue your way?
You know what I've come to see? Is you bring them into the story. The American people are not wedded to the death penalty. They just never think about it. And the minute you can bring them into reflection, a book does that, the film did that, then Tim Robbins has written a play for high school and college students to do, where they take all the parts. They're the guard, they're the victim's family, they're the mother of the death row inmate, they're the governor. They're everybody, and they go into a deeper reflection. What you have to do in a story, and what I do with all the audiences, I do a lot of speaking, is you bring people over to both sides. Let's look at this terrible crime. We're outraged over the crime. Look at this. That person deserves to die. Isn't that what justice means for the victim's family? And then you bring them over to the victim's family suffering, And then you bring them over to the other side, the perpetrator's mother and his family. And the guards who have to do the killing. In Dead Man Walking, I talk about the guards. Nobody thinks about the guards. But they're just regular guys. And they're told tonight, part of your job is you take that person out of their cell and you take them out and you kill them. And they just hope to God the guy goes peacefully, because in, like, you've had situations where the guy fights them all the way and you're looking at a guard and you're just saying, don't kill me, don't kill me. And they know they're killing somebody who's defenseless. Everybody, it costs everybody. We got to move this thing out of this country. We got to change this thing.
I have been thinking about the way that you have told those stories in Dead Man Walking and in your activism over the years, in thinking about the Governor Hickenlooper story in Colorado, because he effectively politically intervened to keep the system in place, but he is obviously tormented in a way that I take very seriously about him not wanting to be one of the cogs in that machine.
No, absolutely.
The machine will stay, but he won't play a part in it, but he's going to leave the machine there. And I think he doesn't want to be one of those guards. He doesn't want to be one of the people making the decision.
No, that's right. And you know, actually, when I'm talking to audiences and I take them there, and I'm honest on both sides, I bring them into the pain on both sides, and I say to them, so if you believe in the death penalty and that it ought to happen, that justice demands it, could you do it? Could you do it? And if there's a part of you that goes, well, I don't know if I could do it, then I say there's a part of your moral conscience that has not said yes to the death penalty. And so reflection is what it's all about. I just came from Oxford University. I come from England. They said, what is it about the American people? Why are you people so vengeful? You're holding on to the death penalty. I said, we're not really holding on to the death penalty. We never think about it. Anything that causes reflection, like your show, where you get your facts and you help people think. The arts, film, books. I didn't know the power of a book when I wrote Dead Man Walking. I'd never written a book before. You know, I'm from the South. Talking is what we do. But I mean, reading books, okay. But it's an intimate experience. And people, they don't have to debate. They get new information. But they're also using their own imagination to go to some deep places. And it's very intimate. And almost everybody comes out not the same on the other end of the book. So I believe in the book and the good work that it's doing. And the film really captured that ambivalence too. Like Tim said, we're not going to do propaganda and we're going to shingle in 400 arguments to get people to be against the death penalty. We're going to bring them over to both sides and leave them there.
When you talk about getting people to reflection and getting people to a place where we can use a part of our mind and our soul that we wouldn't necessarily use, even in an artistic context, is this religious practice? You are obviously a Catholic nun. You are devoted
Catholic
to the life
nun.
Of the church. Is this activism a form of religious practice and getting people to
absolutely
reflect
it in is. That way? I mean, what is the deepest spiritual heart of all of us? Religious practice or spiritual practice, okay? What's the heart of all the traditions is that everybody is my brother and my sister. And I cannot turn a switch and say, you are not human like the rest of us and we can kill you. It is deeply spiritual. It's about the soul of all of us. And I think, you know, I've met so many of the American people over these years, because I've talked to everybody. I talk in synagogues, I talk in universities, I talk in civic clubs, I talk all over. And it's once you can get people to be able to identify that the human being who did that outrageous act is more than that one act in their life. But it's a journey to get there. You can't do it through preaching at people. You can't do it from, you know, just trying to tell, just pure argument.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do it through story. And people are open when people say, let me tell you what happened to me.
Yeah.
Like Susan was talking about the film. Mm-hmm. That was against all odds. They did that film. Every Hollywood studio turned down that film. They never dreamed it could be a box office success. And I tease Susan because she cried when she saw herself in the dailies because, you know, not much makeup and all. You know, it's a first nun thing. And she goes, I don't want to look at the dailies. And then I, on the night of the Academy Awards, and I said, look at that, Susan. Your spiritual essence came out, you know. And so it's like, they're good people. But every Hollywood studio said, well, you got no romantic interest. Let us spice it up between the nun and the death row inmate, and then we'll have us a movie. And Tim's saying, no, that's not what this film is about. It's a journey. We're going to bring people deeper. into the reflection on the death penalty. And after Dead Man Walking came out, notice how movies changed in the United States. They all were deeper. Monsters Ball, Dancing in the Dark, Green Mile, all of them were deeper. Before, the formulaic movie was, is he guilty or not? Yeah, he did it. Justice is done, end with the execution, end of film, and end of reflection. Dead Man Walking left you there, looking at bodies now, the victims here, the guy on the gurney here. Where are we, and what have we accomplished?
Showing and not telling in a way that lets people tell themselves.
Yeah, I learned that little journalistic principle right before I wrote Dead Man Walking. You show, you don't tell, you take people there. And as Tim says, you don't insult the intelligence. Bring them there, you don't have to preach at them.
Sister Helen Prejean, advocate for the abolition of the death penalty, author of Dead Man Walking. It's hard to believe it has been 20 years. I have learned so much from you, from your career.
It's beautiful.
Talking to you tonight.
I'll watch you, I've learned from you, too. Thank you, Rachel,
Thank
for
you.
Your good work.
Thanks.
Well, what an interesting interview. What an interesting person, Gordon. And she's going to be here.
She'll be here on March 5th here in Regina. The event is hosted by Camping College, and we really want to acknowledge the people at Camping College for arranging this. The event will be at the Education Auditorium at the University of Regina, and we'd encourage everybody to mark that on your calendar. And, of course, while you're doing that, also note March 11th, because mentioned earlier, Alex Neve, the senior staff person for the Canadian section, will be in Regina. We're arranging for two events, one at 2:30 in the afternoon, where he's going to be talking about Amnesty International's current campaign to stop torture, and in the evening he'll be speaking at the University of Regina as well. But of course, these events are open to everybody. That's why we scheduled two, including one in the evening. The evening event will be on the topic of putting human rights on the Canadian election agenda, and Alex, with his experience of having been part of research missions in numerous countries around the world, but also within Canada, has got lots of information to share, and I'm sure people will find his presentation very interesting. So a couple of interesting events to mark down. And, well, just in concluding, reflecting back on the first part of the program, please take an opportunity to support the Have a Heart campaign that Cindy Blackstock is the leader of. It's so important, and thank you for listening to Human Rights Radio today.
Yeah, for sure, and I just like to put a plug in again for the thing that Amnesty members do the best, and that's letter writing. And if you want to, you can come down to the Atlantis Coffee Shop Tuesday evenings at 7 o'clock, and we have all kinds of issues that we're writing on, or you can write a letter to whomever you please about whatever issue, in the government or to that's the easy one, because we don't have to pay for postage, which is good. But anyway, having said that, we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For information on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Peter Benenson, founder of Amnesty International, said, "Only when the last prisoner of conscience has been freed, the last torture chamber has been closed, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a reality for the world's people, will our work be done."